Well, Helen, the story I'd like to tell you is the story of my father, Harold Jesser, and the Papuan Infantry Battalion, which he was a member of. The period I'm talking about covers from January 1942, before the war in Papua really started, until January 1943, when it was just finishing with the end of the Northern Beaches campaign. I'll give a bit of background about some of the individuals mentioned on the tapes. I'd made a few hours of tape with my father before he passed away in 1997. The Papuan Infantry Battalion, or the PIB, came into being on the 1st of June 1940. Its role was to be a reconnaissance unit, a fighting unit, and a guerrilla unit. In the early stages, though, it was severely handicapped as a fighting unit. The PIB did not get their first light machine guns until January 1943. But in reconnaissance and as a guerrilla fighting unit, they really excelled. Their first commanding officer was a man called Major Leonard Logan. He'd been in the Royal Papuan Constabulary. He was a good choice to the extent that he knew retired police who would be a good choice for the PIB, and he recruited them. But it soon became apparent that he was not the right leader for conflict. His second in command was Captain Bill Watson. Watson really was the making of the PIB. He was a great sportsman who captained the Wallabies in three tests in the early 1900s. In World War I, he served in German New Guinea, then as a reinforcement at Gallipoli, and finally on the Western Front. In the final year, he was commissioned in the field and awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal, then the Military Cross and Bar. He was a highly decorated soldier. After the war, he was a plantation manager, then a successful gold miner in Papua. On the Kokoda Trail, his conduct under fire was outstanding. For these and many other reasons, he was hero worshipped by his men, both Australians and Papuans. My father, Harold Jesser, volunteered early for full-time service, but his call-up was delayed because he was finishing his apprenticeship. He had been in the Army Reserve, and when he got his call-up, he was sent to Port Moresby as a corporal with the engineers. He commenced there in May 1940. Among the jobs he had in Port Moresby was that of managing the construction of gun emplacements on Parga Hill, which overlooked the harbour. The labour for this job was provided by the new recruits for the PIB. Consequently, Harold Jesser was working with the PIB and with Bill Watson from the start. It was because he got on so well with the Papuans and with Watson that Watson arranged for him to be commissioned as a lieutenant and transferred to the PIB. Now, the labouring work for the PIB continued, but the Japanese entered the war in December 1941, and by late January 1942, Rabaul had fallen. It was assumed that sooner or later, the Japanese would try to take Port Moresby. As the mountains behind Port Moresby were considered to be impassable, it was assumed that that attack would come from the sea. There were pitifully few troops in Port Moresby, so the decision was made to prepare to conduct a guerrilla war from the mountains until help arrived. For that, they would need good maps, maps of the plantations around Sagere in the mountains behind Port Moresby. The job of making those maps was given to the PIB, and the patrol was led by Harold Jesser. In late January 1942, they set about their task.
When we got up there, I was six natives and a fellow from the artillery. We went round. The first place we went to was Old Stepson at Koitaki, and he said, "You're wasting your time." He said, "Every plantation around here has got maps of the area." He said, "They've all got maps. They all are joined then." So what we did, we went around and collected the maps. No, they took a couple. We were given a week or something, 10 days. Sitting down, I said, "What are we going to do now?" One of the natives said, "What about we go to Kokoda?" Yeah, fair enough. So we just packed up and left for Kokoda, but told nobody. And we took, from Koitaki, we saying, not from the jeep head, which was about another day's walk away from, eventually, from Koitaki, 6 days over and 5 days back, because we dropped our, we left Tucker as we went.
Yes.
This day, and we came back with nothing, that's what we're going to camp on, a blanket, and ground seat, that was all. So we had to carry, and when we got back, it was hell to pay. "Where you been?" "Being over to Kokoda." "Kokoda? You walked to Kokoda?" "Yes, we've been over to Kokoda and back. The track wasn't there, see, and they didn't know. There'd be nobody there for probably 50, 60, might be more years.
Jesse had been under the impression that there was no track across the mountains, because that was the official view in Port Moresby. But what he didn't know, and what seemed to have been forgotten in Port Moresby, was that the police had staffed a mail service from Port Moresby to Kokoda from the early 1900s until the mid-1930s. There was no defined track to follow, but it was probably a former policeman who knew the way and suggested they go to Kokoda. This is very significant, because it suggests that Papuans are already thinking about what they might need to know as the war came closer. However, as Jess's recollections show, the news that the mountains could be crossed in a matter of days was received with absolute shock. What happened in Rabaul was on everyone's mind, and the PIBCO, Major Logan, was showing signs of considerable stress. Jesse tells what happened.
Anyhow, I had to go down and report to General Morris. He was all right. He said, oh, he said you should have let somebody know, you know, and that's what he didn't reprimand me or anything. And he was quite interested in the track. He wanted me to do a report on all the rest of it. He said, all right, that's what he said. Return to you, get back to your unit now. He'd finish with me. Now as I got the door, he said, oh, Jesse, he said, if you had to go back to Kirk, would you go? And I said, yes, certainly. He said, all right. Good, he said, I'll let you know. Then it was about a week later, he rang me up. Not, he didn't ring Logan, he rang me up. And he said, I want you to get a platoon together. He said, take another officer with you. And he said, I want you to go to Kokoda. He said, patrol the north coast. I organised everything. Jack Isaac came with me. And I forget who the sergeants were. I probably had three sergeants. Oh no, we had one sergeant, a native sergeant, about 30 natives, organised everything. We're getting on the truck to go up to as far as we could, which was Owen McDonald's place. And Logan rushed in and said, where do you think you're going? Go to Kokoda. Nobody told him. No, he was a hopeless case. He said, we'll soon see about that. Away he went and he got on the phone to Morris. He came back and said, oh, they should have told me. Good boy. I never saw him again.
On the 19th of February 1942, the day that Darwin was bombed for the first time, Jesse set out with Lieutenant Jack Isaac and 30 Papuan soldiers to commence patrolling the north coast of Papua. Their task was to watch for any signs of an anticipated approach by the Japanese and to screen any lines of possible advance on Port Moresby. Major Logan was medically evacuated about this time, and Bill Watson took over as commanding officer of the PIB. Harold Jessup was later promoted to captain and became the officer commanding A Company PIB. On the north coast, Jessup had a monumental task ahead of him. This is one platoon, two lieutenants and 30 soldiers who were protecting the whole north coast of Papua. There was increasing surveillance by Japanese aircraft. The Japanese landed unopposed at Leh on the 3rd of March, and on the 13th of that month, Jesse encountered the Japanese himself. Claude and Alan Champion are mentioned in the recollections at this point. They were the district officers at Kokoda and Boona.
So we got to Kokoda. We went down to Boona. Oh, I just had a look around, up to Yama. Just having a look at where we had to go and what we had to do. And that's what I was at Kokoda. Early one morning it was. Ford had the wireless. We didn't have any wireless. And he told me they were expecting a landing at Boona. And it was in the afternoon, but late afternoon, I got the message. Because I walked all night. Oh, it was about 76 miles, I think it was. I was there next morning. Then, oh, I was a couple of natives with me, that's all. That's when we got to Boona. We hadn't got there long, and the Jap seaplane landed. First of all, Bishop was coming back from Gona in a little motorboat, and they machine gunned him. He put into shore and dived into the swamp the other side, purple jacket and all. And then they the machine gunned the, not the house, but the place where we had the wireless. It was a native place. where the wireless was. And, well, as I said, they turned out and they saw me come in, and Alan, our champion, he was in the house sending a message to Moresby. I raced up and jumped up the house and I grabbed him. I said, come on, get out. The plane's coming straight in. You could see, I knew when they were coming in the machine gun. And we got out and the big mango trees there, we lay there behind him. And they machine gunned the house, they didn't have to wireless. And then they turned out and they turned, they come back and they landed on the water. And before, I only had a Thompson submachine gun, but they were about 400 yards off. Well, that was no good because the Thompson was no good over it. You could see the bullets out of a Thompson, about 200 yards was their maximum. No good close in. So these signal fellows there, there were about six of them. I said, they had 303s. I said, don't let him stop. Don't let him land, If he stopped, machine guns the place. We'd be in trouble. And they wouldn't fire. Oh, they're only kids. So I grabbed a rifle and opened up. And I forget who was with me. One of the natives. It might have been Kamani, Corporal Kamani or one of them. He was with me a lot in those days. And the two, we opened up on the thing. As soon as we opened up, we'd only got about three or four shots away, and he smartly took off and beat it. We made a mistake, they were going for the field. The petrol tank was above the, on the top. But then he turned, when he took off, but he came in high then, and he dropped two bombs. Or might only be 20 pounds or something. It was one either side, the mission boat. No, it did no damage. Really, he did no damage at all, other than give Bishop Strong a drenching. And he came up, and he just walked straight past us, never said thank you or anything else. But he beat it then. He got in his boat and gone and went.
A few weeks after that, the remainder of the PIB began across the mountains to the north coast, and Jessup started allocating them areas of responsibility. He was still doing this when the Japanese landed at Buna and Gona on the 21st of July 1942. Two more individuals mentioned here are Johnny Chalk and Tommy Grahamslaw. Lieutenant John Chalk was a platoon commander who accompanied Jessup at this point and who staged the first ambush of the Japanese in Papua. Tommy Grahamslaw was an Australian New Guinea Administration Unit officer who was working in the area. This time, the encounter with the Japanese was a bit too close for comfort.
Peter and Harold Jesser talking about Harold's military service in New Guinea during World War II.
I don't know where I was when the Japs landed. I might have been at Owala with Bill Watson. Yeah, I think I might have been. Well, I came into Owala just after the Japs landed. And Johnny was there with a platoon. And we had to go down the... Oh, yeah, we came in after the Japs landed. That's right. The simple reason was Tommy Grahamslaw had already gone down the track about 2 hours before us. Well, so we just took off down the track then. And went to warn the missionaries. Johnny went down to Sangara Plantation House, cooking tea. There's plenty of stuff there. They'd all clear, everybody there cleared out. And I went over and warned the missionaries at Dovidura. So I'll be back. Johnny saw him go down. He went down as far as Sangara. And been there, cooked tea. Well, I say that was about the end of the day. And I just come back and walking down the track. And the house was... Oh, about 200 yards back from the track, and see all these fellas standing at the gate. Oh, about 8 or 10 of them, 10 or 12, standing at the gate. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, a blooming Jap. So I don't know whether I went through it or over it, this great big hedge on the side of the road. And the grass was about waist deep. I went across and into the back of the house and sang out to John, said, for Christ's sake, get out, the Jap's at the front gate. He left the tea cooking. We left it for the Japs. We had to get out. Oh, we got out and through the grass. And we went back up and it was the track went up there. Then it forked up to Awala, up to Dobadura Mission. We met it there for a long while. But the Japs never came on because that was getting dark then. But then Johnny was had a, oh, I don't know how many he had. John could tell you better than I could. He might have had 15 or 20 with him. And they took up a position at the, put him at this fork in the road, went back to Awala to tell Bill Watson what had happened. And he said, go back and tell Johnny to hold there. He said to take up a position, keep maintain his position there and have a crack at the Japs as they come up, which John did. And he said to me, he said, you better go and warn the mission people that the Japs are on their way.
For the ambush of the Japanese, John Chalk had just 35 Papuan soldiers armed with .303 rifles. Johnny Chalk himself had a Tommy gun. They had no machine gun support. Chalk selected his ambush site very carefully. The Japanese made local people walk in front of them as a screen, but Chalk let the Japanese come right into the ambush position before giving the order to fire. It was all over in seconds. The Japanese responded with machine guns and knee mortars. The Papuan infantry just couldn't withstand that. And as John Chalk said to me once, I suddenly realised I was the only one still firing. The PIB melted away into the bush and made their way back to Awala. Their adjutant, Lieutenant Colin Goodman, described the PIB soldiers as coming back with eyes like saucers. Some of them did not return for several days or fled all the way back to Port Moresby. The PIB soldiers were severely criticised for this, but it must be remembered that these were people who had no concept of modern warfare. They really didn't know what to expect. And as Harold Jesser said, the first time you're being shot at is a terrifying experience. The Papuans learned fast they could fight their own way. So Jesse was sent back by Watson to warn the missionaries. That patrol took him some 12 miles or 20 kilometres behind the Japanese front. He was accompanied by three PIB soldiers, including Sergeant Katui.
So I went back to Dobadura. While I was away, then the Japs came up the track and John had to crack them. Oh, I think I had Katui with me. We got back there, it was in daylight. There was nobody at the mission. The mission was quite empty. We eventually found them all in the bush, way on a bloody hill somewhere. And we warned them, then so we went back to get back there. But that night we were walking back, and I wasn't going to go back there to where Johnny was. I came around the back again. And then Katui cracked up, his feet cracked up, but he couldn't walk. So I went on my own. Went down and had a look at Awala. There was nothing there, that everybody had gone, so I wasn't going in there. I went to the bush again. I came back in at Ongahambo, I think it was. There was nobody there. So I wasn't going back bush again. I went up the track again. When I got to Kamusi River, Wairopi, that's a Kamusi. It was hanging in the water, the bridge. Into the bush, very smartly. I went right, did a big circle back around the top again, swam the river, and then came back onto the track again. Not to the, near the bridge, back a bit, and I found them. Bill Watson and all his bombs. Oh, and the 39th Battalion, they were there then. They held at the river there for a while. Then we got pushed back to Oivi.
When Jesse was forced to leave Katui, he left the two private soldiers to look after him. Katui recovered and waged a very personal war across northern Papua. He eventually returned to Port Moresby weeks later with the insignia of some 22 Japanese soldiers and officers sewn on his uniform. He said he didn't bother going after them unless they had something worth taking. Harold Jesse was awarded the Military Cross for his efforts on those patrols. The citation reads, "At Awala on the night of 22-23 July 1942, at great personal risk, he took a small patrol of natives and penetrated beyond Sangara, a distance of 12 miles behind enemy lines, and returned to his headquarters with valuable information on the enemy's strength and disposition, thereby enabling the Papuan Infantry Battalion to take up a position and greatly retard the enemy advance." This was the first military cross awarded in Papua New Guinea during the war. And Katui received the Military Medal for his participation. He was the first Papuan to receive such an award. Jesse mentions Oivi at the end of these comments. Oivi became the site of the first major battle of the Kokoda Campaign. It was a very spirited defence put up by just two platoons of the 39th Battalion and some PIB facing much more heavily armed Japanese. But Jesse was not directly involved in this battle, as he explains.
We had an old at Oivey, but there was a track on the, well, what do you call them, used at the AIF used. It goes around Oivey, comes in between Oivey, only about a quarter of the way to Kokoda, if it's about five, coming about 5 miles behind Oivey. Because it was a good track, and the Japs could bypass Oivey on it. Now, Bill Watson sent me out, I had a couple of native boys with me, a couple of troops with me, and six 39th Battalion fellows. And we went over right opposite Oivey and took up a position there on a high, was up on a high bank, that sort of thing. And Bill Watson said, if we've got to get out, he said, I'll let you know. So we hung on there. Never saw a Jap, and it was next afternoon, I think it was. We were there all that, the rest of that day, that night, hear gunfire. Well, they say, we didn't know whether what they were doing, though. Then it was the next afternoon, I could see Kokoda burning. I thought, well, Kokoda's burning, they're not still at Oivey. It was time to get out. So we cut straight through, over, and we came in at Isharaba, and come back down to Deniki. And they were all holding a Deniki then. So we went back then as the Deniki. And no time did I walk straight into these places. And then I say, Deniki there, we just took up positions there.
The battle at Oivey went on for quite some time, and the troops were exhausted, they had no sleep. Watson was in charge by then, had no choice but to lead them out in the middle of the night, in rain, through the Japanese sentries. And they all got extracted safely. They went up to Deniki, and then Watson went back down to Kokoda with them to help defend Kokoda. But the Japanese were, as soon as they realised that Oivey was deserted, the Japanese attacked Kokoda in full force. The commanding officer of the 39th Battalion, Lieutenant Colonel Owen, was killed in the battle for Kokoda, so Watson then took over command of both the PIB and the 39th. They were forced back to Deniki, and they held Deniki for several days. Jesse and his Papuan soldiers were on reconnaissance every day to monitor Japanese activity as they consolidated their positions in the area. It was nerve-wracking work because at any moment they could run into Japanese scouts watching their own perimeter. On the 4th of August, Major Alan Cameron arrived to take charge of the little force at Deniki. Within a few days, he devised a plan to split his force into three and attempt to retake Kokoda. Harold Jesser had been down to Kokoda, and he thought that three groups of about 80 men each lacked the strength and equipment to overcome the Japanese. His Papuan soldiers agreed, but Cameron was determined. Watson and Jesser were with the group that went straight down the track to Kokoda, but as Jesser said, the day they decided to go down to Kokoda, the Japanese decided to come up and attack Deniki, and the Japanese surprised them. Cameron's plan met with disaster, and the Japanese pressed back in a determined effort to oust the defenders from Deniki. The Japanese had brought native labourers with them from Rabaul as well. Now they started using them to go forward and spy on the Australian positions. Jesse now tells what happened then. This is when he came close to exiting from the war altogether.
We were holding Deniki, and the Japs were nearly every day. They were just probing. They weren't attacking. They were just probing patrols to find the weak spots. That's when I got hit. When I got hit, I had the Tommy gun, you know. I was in the bush. I was forward of the slit trenches. We were, you know, up around poking the bush to find and see where the Japs were. That was our job. And there was Ihava, Gabriel was with me.
Yeah.
But we were side by side, never. We might be 20 yards between us, as long as we maintained contact. And then this native started to come down, you know, and that's when I got hit. Oh, it was only, you might have been here to the trough out there, here for the gate. And I always had the Tommy gun ready to fire. I just give him a burst and killed him. I don't know who he was. He was probably a New Guinea native, or a Bell native. Then sooner or later, when that happened, we went beat it straight back. I was there for about 3 or 4 days after. I developed fever, and Bill Watson said, "Oh, you've no good to stay in here, get out." They were just camping, nothing. Never had blankets, ground sheets, nothing. Hat and a shirt and a pair of trousers and gaiters. But when Bill Watson sent me out, there were 6 wounded fellows to go at the same time. He said, go with them. He said, you look after them. They were worse than I was. They were all walking wounded. One fellow got shot. I don't know whether he opened his mouth to talk or whether he yawned. And the bullet came out alongside his spine at the back. His face was all twisted. He was in hell of a mess. But there was no mark in the front of his face or his tongue. Yeah, they were looking after him going out. There was a loot, a salmon. His name. He got shot in the chest. And he'd gone along a rib. He jumped the breastbone and went along a rib and out there. He was a 39th fella, he wasn't one of ours. Yeah, into a hospital up at Koitaki, then down on the Manunda, straight through to Brisbane.
Harold Jesse was shot through the right forearm, and luckily the bullet passed through without striking the bone. But he also had malaria and blackwater fever, and that was why Watson thought it was best to get him out of the action. On his way out to hospital, Jesse passed the 7th Division troops coming in to take up the fight. By the time the 7th Division arrived, the 39th and the PIB had been pushed back to Isharava. The night before the first battle involving the 7th Division was preceded by the usual Japanese chants and taunts, but by now the PIB soldiers were unimpressed. The Australians were amazed to hear the Papuans singing the old American Civil War hymn just before the battle, Mother, on the night before the battle. The Papuans were developing their own style and approach to the fighting. John Chalk recalled the battle of Isharava the next day, with Bill Watson firing his Tommy gun from the hip and bellowing out the charge of the Light Brigade. Cannon to the left of them, cannon to the right of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered. And then to the 7th Division soldiers, get up and fight, you'll never hit anything from down there. The 7th Division soldiers come from the Western Desert, and the combat approach there, which relied on using cover and shooting at the enemy from cover, it didn't suit the Japanese tactics of walking straight up. Even so, as Johnny Chalk said, you wanted to be down hugging the ground with the 7th Division troops, but you wouldn't dare as long as Watson was on his feet. After Isharava, though, the role of the PIB changed. They laid down their weapons, and after each battle they went forward to recover the wounded from under noses of the Japanese. It was a task in which they demonstrated tremendous skill and courage. They also managed the stretcher bearers going back from the front. Much of the legend of the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels is really the story of the PIB. And if you see that news footage, you'll see Papuans there in shorts with short hair with the stretchers. They're not bush natives, they're PIB soldiers. After Kokoda, the PIB regrouped, and in October 1942, they trekked back over the mountains, bypassing Kokoda. The Japanese were now in retreat, and the new task for the PIB was to go back to the north of the Japanese held territory and pick up PIB troops who'd been cut off since the conflict began. Then they were to shut the door on any Japanese escape route to the north. Jesse came back from his period of recuperation in Brisbane to join the PIB up at Garina. He was back in charge of A Company again, but he was sent with a small patrol to determine what the limits were of the Japanese held territory. The patrol he had Gabriel Ahava once again as NCO. Of course, Gabriel was with him when he was wounded. Gabriel and his brother John were two of Jesse's most trusted NCOs.
Then when he got to Garina, then I say... Oh, Bill Watson was there. Bill Watson, I think Cole was there too. And he said, "You better go down because we had no word of at that time of Alan Hooper, Arthur Smith. We had nothing. We had to go down and find out what was going on. Well, first of all, I had to go to the mouth of the Warrior to see if the Japs had occupied there, and then down to Yoma." See if the Japs were in occupation, and then from Yoma down to find out what had happened at the embassy, whether Arthur Smith and Hewitt were still there, or what. I went down the Warrior, and then Alan Hooper in his book says that he was at Yoma. He was not. They were up on a mountain, up on the Warrior River, and that's where Jack Eyes had died, and that's where Jack was buried. No, I left them there. They were nothing to do with me. So I went on then, down the mouth of the Warrior. There was nothing there. Then I come back and then down. It's an inland track down to Yarmouth. Went down, there was nothing at Yarmouth. So I sent, every time I called the warrior, I'd send a boy back to, we never had warriors, sent a boy back to Bill Watson with a message. And we were halfway to Yarmouth, and a native village there, and they said, troops at the mouth of the river. This was on a bit of a river there. So we had to go down there. We got canoes and snuck down there after that, in the dark night. And here's six POV boys, still on guard. Alan Hooper had left them there. They were still doing guard duty there at the mouth of the river. There were no Japs there. I took them with me, sent a message back to Bill Watson, on to Yarmouth, another message back, nothing there, and down to Ambassy, or the Opie River, and Ambassy was just nothing there, then down onto the Camoosie, the mouth of the Camoosie, and the Japs were there at the mouth of the Camoosie, but not on our side, not on the north side. The Japs didn't know we'd been here.
By this time, Jessa had determined the limits of Japanese held territory. He also found that Lieutenant Smith had been executed by the Japanese and Sergeant Hewitt killed in fighting. And he learned the Japanese had executed all the missionaries and their families in northern Papua, men, women and children. Some of those executions had been preceded by the most barbaric treatment of individuals. But now the tables were turned and it was time to let the Japanese know they had a problem. Jessa set up a standing patrol under Warrant Officer Jack McQuatters on the north side of the Camoosie to monitor the Japanese. They soon found a suitable target, but they were still limited in what they could do. The PIB still did not have any Bren guns to add to their firepower. They pretty much had to just hit and run.
We used to, a standing patrol, and they said that all these Japs used to go into this hut, big long hut, every morning. We reckon they were going in there to have breakfast. So we all lined up across this little creek. I might have been hit with a tank wide. Early one morning, I waited for all these Japs to get in to have their breakfast and blew hell out of it. There were two barges there too, we sank. And after we finished giving them a good going over, we got out. First, we weren't going to stay there. There were too many for us. And went back again. Jack maintained his standing patrol. But about a week later, he got kicked out. The Japs come over looking for him. They kicked him out. They didn't get any killed. So then we all retired. The Opie. We used to patrol from the Opie to the Camoosie every second night, or nearly every night. Yes, and so Jack got kicked out, so he come up and he joined us at the Opie. Then we put a standing patrol on the north side of the Opie River. And Gabriel was there. Gabriel was in charge. I had about 12 or 15 natives there. And that's when Boona and Gona and all that were starting to fall to pieces there. Or Gona was. And the Japs started to come up the coast, getting away. Now Gabriel had got it. We had taken all the canoes. What we didn't want ourselves, we either put way up the rivers out of harm's way, or if we couldn't do that, we cut the bottoms out of them. And Gabriel got a good canoe and put it across the other side, on the Jap side, with paddles sticking up in the sand, of course, for them to use to cross the river. Because they'd run pretty fast, the Opie River. But the whole trouble was that he'd fastened a wire from the bottom of it to a peg in the ground. They could only get halfway. They used to wait till they got halfway, then into them. Some of them hit the water and that sort of thing. You got all of them. They never come up in big, really big parties. Might be half a dozen or six or eight or something like that. See? We're never worried about bodies or that sort of thing. Plenty of crocs there.
Those two small encounters were not the only ones that the PIB was involved in at that time. But Jess's patrol on the Opie now sealed off any escape route by land to the north. The only route was along the narrow strip of beach between the sea and the sago swamps. The PIB held that. There was barge traffic along the coast at night and the POB engaged those with rifle fire from the headlands. Some were disabled and grounded. On the 11th of January 1943, they claimed a major prize. A barge was grounded and captured. The six crew were cleaned up, as Jesse says, and the barge was found to be loaded with 303 ammunition from Singapore. The PIB were always short of supplies, so this was a real windfall, but much of it was belted machine gun ammunition with tracer. The PIB soldiers found an unorthodox use for this, and not just in the two Bren guns that they got at long last a few days later. It was the 21st of January 1943, and San Ananda Point, the last Japanese stronghold in northern Papua, was about to fall. The Japanese were desperate to remove the PIB as a threat to the evacuation of their surviving forces. They mounted an attack on Ambassi, which was held by the PIB. Jesse had anticipated their move.
So I was down at Jack McGuatter's, and we come back in a day, because it'd been nothing, so we come back in a daytime. And just as I got back late afternoon, that's when we first received two Bren guns in boxes. Never been opened, and John and Gabriel had them cleaned, everything organised and ready to fire. We engaged the Jap barges that night. I was up on the headland with John, and Gabriel had about 20 down on the beach. When I say up on the headland, we wouldn't have been more than 200 yards, I suppose, 250 yards. Because it just used to come like that in the headland like that, you know. You just walk up on. And he was down on the beach, and there were two Jap barges come along. And we engaged them. And when we opened fire from up the top, well, we told Gabriel knew, like he had his orders not to fire until we opened up on top. And it wasn't long after that to hear, whoosh! Short while after that, another whoosh! What the hell was that? It was Gabriel giving fire orders. They were all firing together. A whole lot of them. Tracers flying everywhere. One of the Jap barges we got these boxes of Vickers machine gun. Anyhow, one of the barges was very badly damaged. You can see the bullets hitting it, or the tracers going into it.
So what happened here, as Jesse said, Gabriel had his section firing tracer in volleys from their 303s. The whoosh sound was the firing of massed rifles. Jesse said that the tracers looked like a band of light leaping from the shore to the barges. They must look terrifying on the barge. His report of the action noted that the barges had one light machine gun, but it was silenced after firing three bursts. One of the barges, as he said, was badly damaged, and they believed it had been sunk. Two barges appeared later that night, possibly searching for survivors. They were seen off by the PIB. Then in the early hours of 23rd of January, the Japanese made a full-scale assault with three heavy barges, carrying at least two machine guns each and a good number of rifles. Jesse had his Bren set up in a crossfire position with Gabriel again on the beach with massed rifles. The barges made two runs at the beach, both times turning back in the face of the PIB fire. On the third run, a fire erupted on one of the barges. Two of them broke off the attack, while the third drifted away, still burning. Jesse's report stated that later a dull explosion was heard. The Japanese made no further attempt to take Ambassi. But in the following month, the PIB killed some 200 Japanese without loss to themselves. With the Bren guns, it was no longer hit and run. The PIB became a fighting unit. Jesse wrote in his report, "The Brens are a godsend and worth the whole outfit in rifles." A few days after the success against the barges, John Ahava saw about 50 Japanese trying to outflank his patrol, which had engaged a Japanese force on the other side of a small creek. John Ahava attacked the force of 50 single-handed with a Bren gun, killing more than 30 of them and dispersing the rest. For this action, he was awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal. A few days later, Gabriel earned the Military Medal for a similar single-handed attack on a Japanese force which jumped a PIB patrol. They were just two of the Papuan soldiers who were recognised for outstanding courage and leadership under fire. The Northern Beaches campaign was not the end of the war for Harold Jesse or for the PIB. But in the 6 months since their baptism of fire at Awala, they had become a formidable fighting force. The Japanese referred to them as the Savage Soldiers. The diary of one Japanese officer killed during the fighting recorded the PIB as moving silently in the jungle, inflicting casualties on us, and then gone like green shadows. The PIB had developed their own style of fighting. It prompted the PIB to adopt the name Green Shadows as their own. Harold Jesse was promoted to Major towards the end of the Northern Beaches campaign. He served out the war with the PIB, sometimes as Battalion 2nd in Command, but mostly as OCA Company. OCA Company was where his soldiers wanted him and where he really belonged.
Peter, we've just listened to the story of your father during World War II and his involvement in the PIB, the Papuan Infantry Battalion. It was incredible audio. What we'd love to know is a little bit about your dad, the man. What happened after the war? Did he get transferred back to Australia? Was he still in the army? Was he discharged at the end of the war?
He was discharged at the end of the war. He was with the PIB till 1946 in Rabaul, and in his own words, he paid off the last few soldiers, switched out the lights and came home. But he came home, I think, a fairly damaged man. The kind of war that he fought, tremendous stresses. And his sister said to me once, "Your father was a very gentle man. I don't know how he ever did the things that he did. But he did them. He was very modest. He never spoke about what he'd done until the last few months of his life, really." And, yeah, he ended up going bush, working in the bush, and fairly just, you know, foreman on sheep stations and that. He just wanted to get away from the world, I think. These days we understand more about what war does to people. He had to cope with it in his own way, but he was a wonderful father to have. He's a true Australian hero, there's no doubt about that.
And how many of you kids were there?
There were five of us. My older brother, John, joined the army, went into the SAS. Unfortunately, he passed away back in the 1990s from a condition that was related to his service in Vietnam. I joined the army myself. It just seemed to be the natural thing to do. I was in psychology corps. I was never at the sharp end of the army, and I guess that's where life takes us. Two sisters and a much younger brother who was sort of an afterthought when he came along.
And your dad was a good father to all of you?
Yeah, he was a really good father. He was someone you could look up to. And as his sister said, a very gentle person. But still, I guess he instilled in my brother and I a sense of honour, sense of duty. And also, he didn't encourage us. But I guess the role model that he was encouraged us to go into the army. And certainly that's something neither of us ever regretted.
You've said that your father didn't talk very much about his war experiences. How did you get this beautiful audio from him?
Well, he would tell us some funny stories when we were younger. And when I was, well into my 40s, he would sometimes talk to me about it, because in those days when he was retired, he read a lot of military history. He'd talk about that and talk about what he did. But the interesting thing is that one of my uncles, who married Dad's sister, I found out many years later, he was the most laid-back person you could wish to meet. But I found out he'd been a commando in Sparrow Force on Timor. And he and Dad, when they used to visit us in the bush, would sit in Dad's office at night with a couple of bottles of beer, talking late into the night. And as my cousin said, I'd love to know what they were talking about, because it was obviously their experiences. But yeah, it was later when he was getting towards the end that I said, "Look, we've got to get it on tape. What did you do?" And by that time, I knew a lot of it. But, getting it down on tape was very important, because I think there's some very important history in that, not just from a selfish point of view, that this is my father's story, but what the Papuans and New Guineans did during World War II is not well recognised, and it really needs to be. They made a tremendous contribution. The PIB had a kill rate of 30 to 1. And that 30 was based on Japanese records of what they lost in contact with the PIB. And that's a phenomenal rate for any military unit.
They played such an important role in defeating the Japanese.
Yes, they certainly did. And the force that was raised in Torres Strait, the Thursday Island, Horn Island group, were very important in, I guess you call it, home defence there. But the Papuan Infantry and the New Guinea Infantry Battalions, they were at the forefront. Finch Harf and Dad said when the PIB were operating there, they were 2 days in front of the AIF forces. They were out there doing the damage, breaking up the Japanese formations, and the AIF was really had a lot of battles, but they were cleaning up after them. The PIB always operated way behind Japanese lines. That was their stock in trade.
Peter Jesser, thank you very much for coming on Service Voices and talking with us about your dad, about his experiences, and bringing his voice with you.
A pleasure, Helen. Now I might get round to writing that book that I've been saying I should write. You've motivated me, I think. Thank you.